And that's how we know the poor have more taste than the rich. And that's how we know the poor have better taste than the rich. Hear the Celtic tiger roar it once more.
And you shall not
hear the Celtic tiger roar it once more. Growing inflation rate in the world. The cost of a rundown house is absurd. This is the dandy age for a low income wage. Ask anyone who's locked in a cage. A couple with kids can't afford a place to live. Even if they have a good job, we're being robbed by the builders and the fat cat government, the League of Greed. And they don't even need for a thing. It's a sin, but it's the nature of the beast. You better go and find a priest and confess, because your greed is gonna leave you soulless.
Hear
the Celtic tiger roar it once more.
And you shall not have
me. Hear the Celtic tiger roar it once more. Gonna live, what we gonna do? We'll have to move in with the woman in the shoe. They're driving us onto the streets, while the fat cat in government cheats and always gets away with his crime. A kid steals a jacket and does time. Just look at the world around you. Tell me, why is there so much need? Because of greed. Because of greed. So greed. Tiger roar, I want more.
And you shall not have a name other God but me. I am your God, you see. And you shall not have a name other God but me. I am your God but me. I am your God but me.
The clock traffic block, the kids coughing black, snot blood clot, billboard. board talking nonsense. Apartment get robbed of content. Shit's tense while the rents increase. Minimum wage stays a piece of feces. Last reason I can't breathe easy. Concrete reaching east, west, north, south to connect your house to some tower of some company power. Acid shower. Thousands of born rare deformity. Suburban golf course, four course feast. City eats it, breezes shit in her condition, leaking in, seeping through the cracks she passed. It's concrete with steel advance.
She's barely breathing.
Against the flesh of the
it's a reason, gasping through the steel and the glassing. The city collapses. The city collapses.
Wasting the architecture, the city center set off sensors. There's mention of violence and cab drivers ride like theme park. It's only ever dark or sharp as light, like night, life, light, and kids are high as kites, fucking or fighting, night vulture, more walking, new macho, got a Glock, heart torment, clot reflector, heat off, and it makes us nauseous from fumes and toxins, and you can thank the sponsors for making it all possible.
She's barely breathing.
Against the flesh of
it. It's a reason, gas bleed through the steel and the glass. The city collapses. The city collapses.
Yes, even against the flesh of the heathen. Yes, even against the flesh of the heathen. I can feel the city waving.
Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Lee Reed with The City from his album Emergency Broadcast. And before that, we had Damien Dempsey with Celtic Tiger, which really is a song about austerity, in that case in Ireland. But I mean, you know, the picture is pretty much is very similar. You know, people losing their homes, people having to work harder and harder for less and less, not even being able to find jobs, you know, youth unemployment going through the roof. I mean, increasingly repressive police actions and state actions, you know, all this kind of stuff. All of this is part of the austerity regime that we're seeing from forced on workers from the capitalist system right now. So, like I said before, we're going to play the panel discussion from last week's anti-austerity summit here at the University of Guelph. The panel discussion took place at the end of that event, and you're going to hear from a lot of different voices. People have been fighting against austerity in various ways in their own communities. So we're going to get into that. We're going to hear from them. And if certainly if you weren't there, I would, you know, definitely encourage you to tune into this. This is important stuff. We had people there from many, many cities. We had people there from like from Windsor, from London, from, you know, from Toronto, as well as from Guelph and like other places. So it was a really brilliant thing. Like, this is the first time anything's like this has happened in this city. So I hope it's not the last. And yeah, so I'm just going to go right into it now. I'm going to start playing it. So please stay tuned back in the USSR.
These reserves were set up in order to further the stealing of the land and the attempted breaking of a community through historical rapes, killings, residential schools, aka attempted genocide, apartheid model reserve systems with starving out and malnutrition, environmental racism, and continues today in many ways across many communities. depth of the poverty that many Indigenous individuals and families are living in is actually much greater than any numbers themselves will tell us. But half of status First Nations children in Canada are living in poverty. Half. Food insecurity for Aboriginal children and adults living on and off reserves range from 21% to 83%, compared to 3 to 9% for non-Aboriginal Canadians. And as always, remember that those most likely impacted by poverty are women. So yes, we need to keep talking and keep talking and keep talking about the 9,000 missing and murdered Indigenous women in this country. Officials have long been aware of a pattern of racist violence against Indigenous communities, but government response has been shockingly out of step with the scale and severity of this tragedy. But beyond that, where is the collective, consistent, and ear-shatteringly loud outcry from the activist community? In challenging austerity and poverty, we must take direction and leadership from Indigenous struggles and knowledge. Creating supportive and community-based models while holding the Canadian government accountable in order to challenge poverty in our communities is an anti-colonial struggle, not simply one of austerity. It is important to always incorporate this into our critical analysis. We are here as a result of blood that was shed by colonization, and we must recognize and look at the efforts of those who came 7 generations before us. Our land acknowledgement cannot exist in the past tense or his historical context. Colonialism is a current and ongoing process, and we need to every day think about the ways in which we're participating in it and challenge it. I'm just going to ask 4 questions for you folks to think about while you're listening to this panel. How are you connected to the land where we stand currently? Who in this or your area is doing work around Native sovereignty? Who in this or your area is doing work around settler accountability? And how are you connecting your activism and your struggles to Indigenous solidarity? Thanks for coming. I hope you take some time to think about all those things as we move forward with this really exciting and awesome panel. Obviously really heavy thoughts, but you know, this is a really important issue. I wanna just take a moment before I go into some of the other details to thank Darius for the huge amount of work that he's put into making this happen. Give a round of applause. Since Darius has come to Guelph, he has continued to shake a lot of shit up and cause a lot of problems, which is what we like to see. So Darius, thanks for coming to Guelph and for organizing this really important event, and it's really exciting to see folks from so many different communities coming together. Just a couple ideas, not necessarily ground rules, because screw rules, but ideas around how we can move forward with intentionality, with the idea and knowledge that most of the time people up here are going to be the ones talking, but there will be opportunities for people to contribute at the end. So let's talk about the ideas of intentionally constructing a space. The notion of trying to create a safe space where everyone is welcome, it just isn't really a real thing. Safe space is kind of bullshit. So talking about the fact that the folks who usually have the privilege of defining space like that are not people who are often most in need of it. So let's move towards building accountable spaces to build better spaces that we all can offer perspective on and give feedback on and call each other both in and out. Saying that, that means that while we're in, while we're listening and while we're contributing to the conversations, that means that we need to remember how much space that you're taking up. So the idea of speak up, listen up. So if you're someone who talks a lot, maybe just listen the whole time. The whole time. And if you're someone who doesn't ask questions and you have that one brain, I really push you to challenge yourself to speak up, because we really want to hear what you have to say. Another thing is no personal attacks. Address the issue, not the person. Don't talk over or cut people off. Try and use plain language. We're talking about things that makes a lot of sense to not get up on our academic jargon. I know when I get nervous sometimes, I get all academic-y. It's like a safeguard. So really challenging ourselves to not do those things. Remember that we all cause harm and we're all survivors of harm. We all make mistakes, but need to be ready to hear about it and learn from it. I encourage people to lean into their discomfort. Open yourself up to hearing new things. Remember that we're talking about a lot of really intense shit. You've had a whole day of really intense shit. I feel like we just need one day tomorrow just to debrief all the intense shit with some like interpretive dancing and beer. I'll organize that next year. That's the debrief day with the beer and the dancing. And I also want to remind folks that when they're talking to other people in this space and when they're asking questions, We live in a police state. The criminalization of dissent is a very real thing, for some people more than others. So unless you really want to, don't indict yourself. That means don't say things in this space that might get you into trouble later. Sometimes jokes can be used against you on stand in the most ridiculous ways. Ask some people in the room about that. And I just want to remind people that there is going to be conversations of racism, colonialism, rape culture, misogyny, and I really encourage folks to trust their own reactions and feelings about that. These are really heavy conversations, and I'm going to just end with one of the baddest of the babes, Audre Lorde. Many of us enter social justice work as survivors, and it's important to the movement that we recognize the self-community care is valuable. Caring for myself is not self-indulgent. It is self-preservation. It is an act of political warfare. So take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Check in. If you want to debrief, there's folks around who would love to do that and have conversations with you. And can we just have, before we move forward, one more round of applause for Darius? Yay! And also Sakura, let's be honest. Darius doesn't do anything without Sakura doing, like, I don't even know what percentage of it. And also to this, like, really, I'm going to drop an F-bomb, sorry about that, fucking kick-ass panel, because holy shit, this is a good-looking panel. Hot damn. How much knowledge and experience and badassery exists in communities in Southern Ontario. Like, no wonder the government might be listening to this room, because there's so much badassery and awesomeness and potential for change in this space, and that that means that we're going to, you know, take over and it'll be great and fun.
Yeah, listen up.
So, yeah. So I'd like to thank you up. I'd like to ask up Mandy. I asked her if she would dance up on stage.
I'm not going to.
I asked her to deep lunge up. She got snarly. So Mandy's going to be facilitating the panel. So Mandy, thanks for being so great.
Yeah.
There's no mic, but that's where you can project.
Where is the mic?
Oh, there's a mic.
Don't listen to him.
Okay, no, I don't. I try not to. Okay. Thanks, Sarah. Fun. Okay, so the way this is going to work is we've asked each panelist to speak for approximately 10 minutes, 15 at the very most, because we want time for questions. So we have 6 fabulous speakers. We have, can you just put your hand up when I say your name? We have Mina Ramos from the End Immigration Detention Network and Fuerza Fuerza. We have Sakura Saunders. We have Danielle Bossano. We have John Clark from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. We have Mike Palasek from the national who is the national president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. And we have Mohammed Akbar, who is the former vice president of the University of Windsor's Student Union. So we are going to start with Mohammed. Mohammed was a student at the University of Windsor and was involved in the student union there for 3 years. He was also the CFS Ontario Treasurer, and he moved to Waterloo this past April to work for Ellis Perg at Laurier, which is awesome.
There we go.
Mohammed's going to talk about austerity and students.
Okay. Sorry, just give me a second. I want to time myself so I don't go over. Okay. So, hi, I'm Mohammed. I'm here to talk about how students are dealing with austerity and the effects of austerity on students, generally, students and austerity. So there's no question that students are facing the effects of austerity in the various communities that students are facing them, whether it's, I'm going to primarily talk about post-secondary education, because that's generally what I know about more, but it's across the board. And it's across Canada and across the world. So this is not something that's just happening in Canada. And students, frankly, are, in many areas, rising up to face it. There's, even as close as Quebec, there's massive protests, literally protests against austerity directly. I'm sure you all were inspired, as I was, by the student strikes in 2012, but a lot of people don't know that these strikes, A, have been happening far before 2012, but B, are continuing to this day, and students in Quebec are still pushing an agenda of anti-austerity and anti-poverty work. And even, I was just reading an article, some people who I worked with in Windsor who were on exchange got expelled from their university for protesting against austerity and fighting against the austerity agenda, and are still struggling and dealing with that right now. In India, students have been at the forefront of most social movements for years, for many, many years. And just in this past year, there's current protests going on, not only to fight against the broader agenda of the Indian government, but at individual universities for the individual agendas. That's how I look at universities and institutions of higher education. There's really two levels where students are fighting and where it's important to fight. Of course, there's the we have to fight against the government and what they're imposing. I'm going to go through that in a bit. But there's also the local administrators who make it possible for the government to engage in these agendas and act as agents for the universities and for colleges, who make those individual decisions and who should be challenged when they make them. And they should be challenged hard. So we are a regional summit, so I thought we'd stick to Ontario and to southwestern Ontario. So obviously I have a lot of experience at Windsor. I'm going to talk a little bit about Guelph. Seeing as we're on the Guelph campus, we might as well talk a little bit about what Guelph has been up to in the past few years. So I want to start with the simple principle that personally, I believe, and I don't know if I'm telling any tales or if people vastly disagree with this point, but post-secondary education should be public, fully public, and it should be accessible to everyone. That means tuition fees shouldn't exist. We shouldn't be paying the highest tuition fees in the country, Ontario, or any tuition fees anywhere for education. Education is a right, not a privilege. And it's no surprise that most Canadians, when asked, do you think post-secondary education should be free, say yes. And even if they didn't, it'd still be the right thing to do.
Unfortunately,
that's been changing for a while. So the universities have existed primarily as private universities since like the early 1900s or a little bit before that. And for a time, universities were dominated by a certain type of people, primarily people who were rich who could afford it. At some point, close to the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people started pushing governments to engage in policy to reduce tuition fees and things like that. And to an extent, folks were somewhat successful. Tuition fees and funding for post-secondary institutions remained relatively stable until the 1990s. And so this is where I'm going to start talking about Ontario specifically. In the 1990s, Ontario's tuition fees were about $1,400 when adjusted for inflation, which is still pretty high, especially given the time. But you compare that to now, in 2013, tuition fees hit about $7,000 per year. And that's the average. So many students are paying much higher. Some students are paying lower. It depends on what program you're in. International students pay way more than that. They pay about double on average. And for most international students, because they're brought here through master's programs, they end up paying three times that, so around $21,000.
When I was at Windsor,
I worked a lot with students, and I worked in the student unions and things like that. And what I got involved in was primarily helping students. That was kind of my role. So I've literally helped students who have been eating at food banks because they can't afford the massive tuition fees and are trying to graduate. I've helped students who've literally dropped out because they're working two jobs. They have many, many people who rely on them, many dependents. Older parents, myself, I have two parents who have needed my help since the first day I stepped into university. And yeah, that impacted my education. And there's a lot of students who weren't able to graduate because they had to take care of their parents, take care of their kids, and things like that. And it's devastating to think about that. You think there's hundreds of students who are eating at food banks because they can't afford tuition fees because that's the system of education we have. Or there are students who have to drop out because they just can't afford it. And international students, there are many who left. They came, they spent $40,000, $50,000 for 2 years of education, and at some point they just hit a wall because international students' tuition fees increase by any number. They can increase by any percentage because they're deregulated. And we're seeing deregulation hit domestic students as well, but international students have been dealing with that since the 90s and have faced huge, huge implications for it. And once you leave Canada as an international student, you don't get to come back. It's not, oh, I now have another $20,000. You don't get to renew your student visa.
And unfortunately, that's the system we live in.
And it's not like the governments are paying attention to this kind of thing. The federal government, and this is a big issue for fighting against tuition fee increases and the various issues students face. Governments aren't interested in that conversation. You can present them with everything, and well, look who we're dealing with. Of course, they're not interested in having that conversation. The federal government blames the provincial government. The provincial government blames the local administrators. And the local administrators blame everybody else. That's what students are met with when they try and do this work. Even when we look at what Quebec students are dealing with, aside from the massive violent response from various police forces against students protesting and engaging in different strikes, when they do choose to meet with the government, what does the government say? We don't have the money. You should talk to your local administrators. They're the ones who are spending the budget. They're the ones who can do all this kind of thing. It's a blame game, and it's the reason they do it is so that they don't have to actually deal with the problems. But there is one thing that the Ontario government specifically really likes dealing with, and that's debt. They love loans. Just love handing out loans, giving out loans, anything to do with loans. If you want to talk to the government about loans, they'll approve it right away. And there's two reasons why they do that. One, governments, especially the provincial government, makes a decent amount of money from loans. The OSAP system that's in place now, that's a relic of another government that had an austerity agenda, they make a ton of money because those who are poorer, they pay less each month for their loan. It seems very reasonable to many until you realize that under that system, which is called income contingent loan repayments, those who are in poverty end up paying more after graduation through interest and a variety of other issues. So governments love that. They make tons of money off these loans, and then they make more money through taxes. So it's a great system for them.
But this is seriously hitting students. A report that was released by the Canadian Federation of Students talked about how...
And first of all, this is a really important issue. Let's be clear. Free tuition fees is absolutely 100% possible. It's possible from the federal government. It's possible from the provincial government. Both could do it really easily. And there's reports that show exactly how you could do it. All you have to do is increase tax a little bit on the wealthiest of corporations. A simple tax on financial transactions so that's when big corporations change their money from Canadian to US to make a small amount of profit. If you charge that by 0.1%, you could make $2 billion. That could directly go to funding education and making it cheaper to attend and seek a higher education. The federal government has more than enough money to fund and to erase the debt of every student in the country, but they don't. They have other priorities like jet planes and tanks and armored vehicles. But there are reports that show that this is possible, and there are also reports that say that the average debt of a graduate student or a student graduating from post-secondary education is $27,000. That's just for a regular degree, not like a master's degree or anything like that. It's for a simple bachelor's. In Windsor, where I'm from, you could buy a house with that much money. You could buy a house and a car if you're lucky. And students are taking on this debt with the idea that it's going to help them get a job. That's really what a lot of students think is the purpose of education, because that's what governments want individuals to think, that higher education is all about getting a job. I wonder, does anybody really agree with that notion that, you know, you're supposed to get a higher education to get a job? Is that like...
Oh.
No? Okay. I was just wondering. I wasn't sure if I was alone in that. No, it's a ridiculous assertion. That's not the purpose of higher education. Colleges in the 70s were actually created, to be fair, to... Colleges were invented for that reason. They were invented to create trades and things like that. But regardless, post-secondary education is not for the purpose of getting a job and fitting into this neoliberal agenda. That's not what it's for. And students are fighting against this, but students have many issues that they're facing. The system is designed to make it hard for students to engage in social justice. And those who do engage in social justice face huge barriers, not only socially, but in terms of their education. It's very difficult to... And I struggled through this with all the responsibilities that you have as a student. It's even more difficult to take on more to work in social justice in these kinds of areas. And that's why it's hard to see. I'm really happy. How many people here are students or recent grads? I always ask this because it's really great to see so many students, and you know everybody is a student in their own way, but to see so many students from institutions coming and trying to be involved as best they can,
I find that really important. I'm just going to quickly go through some stats just because I have a lot of information that I do want to give you all. In 2011, 52% of the university's enrollments came from the highest income quartile.
So like the highest income percent.
while barely 10% came from the lowest.
And some people think colleges, as I mentioned, that they're considered to be trade schools are much better, but in fact, 43% of their enrollment came from the higher rate, highest income quartile, while only 10% came from the lowest. And it gets worse. You know, I talked about administration. They waste a ton of money in terms of universities. I know personally, I have tons of experience with the University of Windsor's administration. You know, they get $100,000 to renovate their office when they come to a VP role. $100,000. Wow. I wonder where these tuition fees are going. You know, if a new administrative office needs laptops, well, why stop it there? We need tablets in case we travel, and we need new computers as well. In 2012, the government kind of committed to this process of trying to tear down any hopes of social justice in universities by creating the strategic mandate agreements, which is a process of differentiation. What that means is that they want each university to pick a specialty, which is code for cut everything. Cut everything except this specialty and just focus on that. The result is going to be devastating. I can tell you that already. Very quickly, I'm going to conclude on this. One of the big problems we see in student organizations is that everyone is divided. Everybody fights each other all the time. And that's a fact of progressive organizing at times. But it's good to see everybody here, and hopefully we can all work together. Whatever organization you represent, we should be focusing on fighting the people who are bad for our communities. There are such people. I primarily call them the right wing. But there are bad people, and we should be fighting against them. For any more information you want on these kinds of issues, I highly recommend you check out the Canadian Federation of Students. They are the progressive experts on everything student. They are the oldest, largest student union in the country and are amazing. And I also highly recommend, for those of you at Waterloo, Laurier, Western, Queens, Trent and Oshawa, Brock, and McMaster, look up the Ontario Undergraduate Student Alliance, because they're a group that actively promotes tuition fee increases, and they actively increase debt loads. They're responsible for the income contingent loan repayments, and they were literally sponsored by the Liberal government when they were founded. And they're bad people, and they shouldn't be representing students. Thank you for your time.
Questions for Muhammad, if you could hold those, and we're going to move on to the next speaker, who is Sakura Saunders. Sakura is a longtime environmental justice activist. She organizes with the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network and Rising Tide Toronto, and is also the editor of protestbarrack.net, and she will be speaking on austerity and the environment.
Hey everybody, I'm so happy to get the opportunity to speak to you today about something that I've done a fair bit of research on and I just think is absolutely absurd when we talk about the intersection of austerity and the environment. There's many intersections that I'm going to talk about, but one of the first is the fact that austerity and the environment, or cutting corners and cutting costs when it comes to the environment, puts the public at risk. And of course, there's a very recent example of it, which was when the Kitsilano Coast Guard base was shut down. Do you guys know about this case study? It's pretty crazy. So, despite warnings that BC did not have sufficient marine safety resources in place, the federal government cut all funding to this Coast Guard station, amounting to, you know, $700,000 a year. So not very much, right? At the same time, this was the only Coast Guard station in Canada's busiest harbor. It responded to an average of 300 marine distress calls per year. So it was really obvious to anyone that this was a station that was in high use, that was very necessary, and then of course, you know, very recently, there was a bunker that was leaking fuel from a cargo ship called the Marathassa in English Bay. And at that time, there was a 47-foot ship that was equipped with oil recovery tanks, skimmers, and a boom. Everything that would have been needed to quickly slap a Band-Aid on that spill. And that ship was on blocks. And all of that shift staff were, of course, out of work. So this is just one of the most recent and obscene examples of this. But of course, the omnibus budget bill, Bill C-38, cut far more than one Coast Guard station. They eliminated 3,000 environmental assessments that would have been required federally before that, including one for, of course, the Line 9 pipeline, which passes through the communities of 9.1 million people. This pipeline is going to be put online this month without even a hydrostatic test, which was recommended by the Ministry of Energy. So the National Energy Board waived even the recommendations of the Ministry of Energy in terms of the basic safety precautions that should be taken for this. And, you know, of course, also with the omnibus cuts, there used to be over 1 million protected waterways, but when the Navigable Waterways Act was reformed, that number was reduced from over 1 million to under 200 waterways that were protected. And these were all the specific lobbying issues that the oil lobby came to a Harper government with. And it was because it was exactly what needed to be eliminated to follow through with Harper's oil infrastructure plan. Now, with public risks also comes public costs. And I think a great example of this is the fact that, you know, there's abandoned mines all over Canada. So on a global scale, 75% of the world's mining exploration companies come from Canada. 75% of the world's mining exploration companies. And one of the reasons that it's such a big industry locally is because of, obviously, there's still a lot of mines within Canada. And abandoned mines, which the government treats as a legacy issue, but is still happening today when these companies go bankrupt, conservatively, the amount of money that's spent on these is per year is over $200 million in Quebec, over $500 million in Ontario, over $555 million in the Northern Territories. So now that I'm talking about, you know, I've kind of made clear what the public costs and risks are associated with these terrible cuts, I want to address the fact that it's not because there isn't enough money. I think with Harper, it's really clear that, you know, it wasn't about saving money with this omnibus bill and reducing all of these regulations, but it was about pushing a specific agenda of people that his administration is extremely closely tied with. Shamefully, all of the political parties are fairly tied with this particular power base, though I think it's an opportune time right now where that base is weakened because of economic conditions. Strangely, because Saudi Arabia decided to sell oil really cheap. But not enough money. So one really absurd example, obscene really, is how Harper tried to shut down the experimental lakes. The experimental lakes would have cost $50 million to shut down, but only cost about $2 million to keep going. And these were renowned around the world lakes for discovering how to rehabilitate lakes that had been poisoned. Of course, it was so valuable, and because scientists organized for years, they actually got an NGO to come take it over. But you know, that is just one example of how, you know, it wasn't because of the cost. It was because specifically of this particular agenda and because of this war on science, and especially any science that gave a different narrative than Harper wanted people to be hearing. You know, another example, you know, and this is kind of chump change, but, you know, the government spending $8 million just to audit 7 large environmental NGOs. Again, a lot of money being delegated for a concerted attack. And something that I wanted to mention as well regarding universities is that while people are saying that there's not enough, government are saying that there's not enough money for universities. Well, whenever a private donor comes to give money to a university, the provincial government and the federal government are lining up to match that donation. And what that means is that the government is giving all this money. You know, one example is, you know, the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. It's a famous contract because some professors threatened freedom of information and were able to uncover this very secretive contract and show exactly what strings were attached to this. Well, Monk put in $25 million over like 10, 15 years, and he gets to call it the Monk School of Global Affairs. He gets to say how that money is spent. You know, I think something like $250,000 a year is going to be spent just on PR, you know, promoting his name. While the federal government and the provincial government both gave $25 million. Now, I thought that Monk was a special case because, well, you know, Barrick and Peter Monk have a lot of power, politically speaking, at least they used to. But I was talking to a friend that's an administrator for a vice president at a university in Hamilton, and he was telling me, oh, no, that's every single one. Every single time, like, a corporation comes and gives a grant, we're scrambling to get federal money. That's the only way we're going to get federal money to be given to these universities. And so again, you're getting this public money that is given, and who is controlling that? The private donor. Who is making the terms of that agreement? The private donor. But to take it back a bit and talk a little bit more about how much money the government is giving to these industries, the IMF actually came out with a study. This is bizarre that the IMF did this. But they estimated that Canada gave $34 billion a year in subsidies to the oil and gas industry. Now, this figure, which again was calculated by the International Monetary Fund, was criticized because lots of it was potential money, right? Well, lots of it is, you know, money that we could get by taxing carbon, pricing carbon, or doing things that could create a lot of revenue from this ridiculously large and profitable industry. But if you want to go just to the subsidies, right, just to the money that is government's kind of giving to these industries, according to the WTO definition of what a subsidy is, subsidies in 2008 were... for the federal government, $1.38 billion. For Alberta, it was $1.05 billion. For Saskatchewan, it was $327 million. And for Newfoundland and Labrador, it was $83 million. So even when we're just talking about handouts, these are significant amounts of money that are going to industries that are making like in the billions every year. I'm running out of time, but I just want to tell a quick story because... it's something that really angered me. So a lot of my work is around international mining justice. Because as I said earlier, Canada is headquartered 75% of the world's mining exploration companies. And lots of these companies, the big ones, have headquarters elsewhere as well. But you know, a majority of mining capital is raised on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and this is an area where Canada has a lot of influence. And there is this campaign because there's all of these horrible abuses that happen at these mining companies, at these mining operations around the world, targeted assassinations, militarization of entire communities where people are getting shot, you know, over one a month at one mine site, you know, like war zones. Like these companies are turning these communities into war zones. And it's awful. And so we have this campaign called the Roundtables on Corporate Social Responsibility. And in these roundtables, there were closed-door meetings and there was public forums to talk to people that are directly impacted, to talk to NGOs that are working on this. And the NGOs and the mining sector got together and they came up with consensus recommendations on how to deal with the mining abuses. Because the mining abuses were so bad and they were so obvious that even the mining companies, even the Prospector and Developers Association of Canada, were able to come to the table and come up with these recommendations of what to do about it, right? Now, Harper didn't respond to this consensus, even though the mining companies had agreed to it. And, you know, part of it was getting an ombudsperson, part of it was, you know, having these international standards, you know, of human rights and environmental norms. And instead, he came out with his own paper. And this paper was supposed to be a response to this roundtable's report. And it was called Building the Canadian Advantage, a CSR strategy for the international extractive industries. And what this report did was it decided that indeed there is a problem with the Canadian mining sector. They're obviously not good enough at publicizing their good works. They're horrible at PR. They're known for murders. They're known for all this awful stuff. And they're bringing prosperity. And so what we're going to do is we're going to redirect CETA funds by the millions to promote CSR projects, corporate social responsibility projects at these mine sites around the world. And what CETA did was they started defunding human rights groups like Kairos and Peace and Development that were working with the victims of Canadian mining abuses. And they started directing this funding only to development NGOs that were willing to work with corporations. And instead of an ombudsperson, they named a CSR counselor who wasn't even allowed to investigate these corporations unless they had permission from that corporation. And the first person that they named to that post was Marquita Evans, who was one of the long-running directors of the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto. The center that was created by these private, you know, donations and that control. So I want to end there, but I don't want to have too little hope here, because I just told you some really devastating news.
Yeah.
That, you know, what was preceding that was a consensus between the mining industry and civil society. And, like, obviously, like, you know, Harper is even bad for, like, government. And, like, I think that, you know, pretty much anyone that comes into power are going to have to hold their feet to the fire on this one, on all these things. And so I just wanted to say that the reality of our government and what it's done in the past many years is way off even, you know, people that we consider our enemies, what they would do. And so there's a lot of room for improvement. And I would like to end on that note. And hopefully, you know, like me, you can weaponize the information that I shared instead of allowing it to get you down. So thank you.
Mike is the national president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. He's a letter carrier from Vancouver and has been involved with anti-capitalist organizing for 15 years. He's done work with the anti-war movement, the movement against the occupation of Palestine, and has organized new workers into the labor movement with several different unions. He was elected president at CUPW's convention last month in Toronto. And he will be speaking about austerity and labor. And just a reminder that if you have questions for Mike, we're going to take those questions right away after he speaks.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm not sure how I can possibly fill 10 minutes with the topic of austerity and labor, such a narrow field. But I think to start with, we need to recognize that austerity isn't some force on its own. It's not some decision that bad people are making or a bad government is making. It's a systemic problem. And when we talk about the austerity drive, when we talk about the cuts to social programs, the lowering of wages and living standards and all of this, we can't actually put that in context without talking about the capitalist system itself, which is the real root of this. It's the private ownership of all of the main industries and the corporate domination of our planet. That is what the real driving force of austerity is, and if we're not talking about that, we're going to be running ourselves in circles. I think if you look around the world, you can see that the austerity drive is happening everywhere. You know, that's got to tell us that these are systemic issues. And every government that's brought to power is forced to bring in austerity, forced to attack wages and working conditions, forced to attack the labor movement, forced to attack social programs, even when they're elected on a left-wing platform. You know, look at France, where the socialists were elected, promising massive tax hikes on the rich and so on. How long did it take before that plan was scuttled? Not long. So this isn't just a question about individual choices of governments. It's a systemic question. And it's not. It's also not about money. I mean, that's been mentioned a couple times. They want us to believe that there isn't enough money in this country to provide a decent standard of living for everyone. That's garbage. In a country as rich as this one, where the productive capacity has never been higher, there is absolutely no reason that we couldn't provide a basic standard of living to everybody here. Absolutely none, except the economic system, which is actually dominating this country. And if you don't believe that line, if you don't believe that that the money is there, well, you just have to look at the figures. Because we keep hearing about this economic crisis, economic downturn, that the economy's in trouble. Well, who is the economy in trouble for? That's a bigger question. Because it's not in trouble for the rich. It's not in trouble for the corporations. This year, Canadian corporate profit margins are at a 27-year high.
Shame.
They've been making more money. They'll be making more money this year than they've made in 30 years. And they tell us they don't have enough money to afford the living standards that people had in the 70s or the 80s. It's garbage. Labor costs are rising, are expected to rise at an average of about 1% this year. That's about the inflation rate. Profit margins are going up. Workers are getting paid less. That's the reality. So how has the labor movement responded to this austerity? Well, the first response was to put our heads down. And, you know, that's not surprising. When you start seeing people get laid off, when you start seeing all of these pressures, the first response is going to be to try and think, how can we get around this? How can we avoid it? And I'll tell you about a conversation I had a couple years ago with a former national president of a major Canadian union, who will remain nameless to avoid any political squabbles. But after his retirement, this is a union that's taken major beatings. They've lost huge numbers of their members as they watch their industries disappear. And he said to me, "Mike, we fucked it all up." That was the starting point. He said, "We thought that we could negotiate the cuts and somehow mitigate the damage. That it would be better if we agreed to the concessions, because we could somehow control things more. But the truth is, every concession they took, every bad collective agreement they took, only alienated their own members. It only turned more and more activists away. It only weakened their union's ability to resist. And when it came to the next round, they came back for even more. Because the truth is, it will never be enough. It will never be enough. No matter how many cuts we take, no matter how much they push down our wages, our working conditions, they will always try to come back for more. We need to get our heads around that. And I don't think the labor movement as a whole has done that yet. But I think there are also a lot of reasons for optimism. We're seeing a lot of changes taking place. Changes in society as a whole. People are becoming more politically aware. People are demanding more from their representatives. They're demanding more from their unions, and they should. Because you hear union leaders get up and talk a lot about all of the bad things that the government's doing to them. You know, I could get up here and tell you all of the bad things that Harper's doing to Canada Post, but I think you know. They're trying to dismantle it. They're trying to destroy it, right? Union leaders have got to stop this victim line. We're not victims. The role of the labor movement isn't to talk about all of the bad things that are happening to us. It's to find ways to stop them. It's find ways to mobilize your members to stop them. And I think that's why we're starting to see the sorts of changes that we are seeing. Last year, for the first time in history, a sitting president of the Canadian Labour Congress was defeated at a convention. And he was defeated by an opponent who was making some rather radical talk. You know, they talked about general strikes. about occupations. That was the talk on the convention floor. And that was the direction people were looking for. Has that panned out? Well, I guess we've yet to see it. We've seen, CAPE recently is elected a progressive and more militant leadership in their union. We saw similar changes at my convention last month. People are demanding more from their leaders, and they should. And we're also seeing a sort of rising tide of opposition. I don't think anybody in this room 6 months ago would have predicted that there would be an NDP government in Alberta.
Yeah.
Now, you might have problems with the NDP. So do I. You might say that, you know, they're not challenging capitalism. There are a lot of issues there. But you can't deny that this is a major social change that's taking place. And right now, the latest poll is putting the NDP about 5 points ahead of the Conservatives in the lead on a federal scale. They're within, you know, if they can get another 4 or 5 point bump going into the polls, they're looking at majority government territory. And as I said, no matter what you think about the NDP, you cannot deny that that would be a political earthquake in this country. It would be a paradigm shift. Since Confederation, this country has been ruled by two parties, in one form or another, that both represent the same people. This is the first chance we have to break their grip. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that the NDP is going to magically solve everything. And if they do form government, they're going to be under massive pressure from the banks and the corporations. They'll go to war to stop an NDP government. We'll see an investment strike. We'll see media attacks. They'll go all out trying to stop them from making any progressive changes. So the key to actually doing something about this is to make sure that if they do get in government, they get even more pressure coming from us. That's the only way to make sure they're not going to buckle under that pressure from the right wing. And I've seen that again and again. I come from BC, where the NDP is formed, is almost a natural governing party there. I've seen NDP governments legislate workers back to work and cut welfare. Yeah. I've also seen them make huge advances for people. And it only happens when there's a mobilization to put pressure on. So we have to build these movements. We have to build this tide against austerity, against capitalism, against the corporations that are controlling our planet. And we got to make sure that we're in the streets. Sure, let's fight the election, but we can't stop there. We've got to bring down Harper, but we also have to make sure that whoever comes in after him has to deal with a mobilized, radicalized labor movement that can take on not just the government, but the banks and corporations behind them. That's our job. Saying that without the consent of the working class, not a wheel will turn and not a light bulb will shine. Well, that's the truth. Workers run the world, and if we're organized, we have the power to stop the world from running. That's a tremendous power. So the question is not, you know, how we stop them, it's how we organize that, how we mobilize that. And we'll have a lot of work to do to get to that place where we can do that, where we can actually make the ruling classes tremble. But I think every action we take, every occupation, every strike, every wildcat, helps build that. And every time the community rallies around those instances, it helps build confidence that we can take these things on.
Does a labor movement have limitations, though? It's sort of a reformist organization. They need political leadership. They have to build it in the NDP or outside of it. What leadership do you see? Could it be a mass movement in working with the labor movement and the segments of the left and NDP?
Well, I think there's a lot of different directions it could go. You see in some countries where you have this sort of